Well, I was myself over here. He invited me to speak. And now for the second account of the four Gospels. That was one of the best sermonettes I've heard in a long time, I told my wife. I should like, since we have a little time that this is national holiday, as well as God's holy day, to take just a bit of time on the subject that he mentioned, since I didn't teach for many years the area of the background of the Old and New Testament. I would draw attention to a few things that I could add here that might help you understand a little more of the material. Probably the simpler way that I would do it to remember would be to think of them all in terms of the function of Christ, if you wanted to. That is, Matthew certainly addresses Christ as the King, and Mark as the servant, and Luke as the Son of Man, and John as the Son of God. What I wanted to mention is that Matthew's account, which we now have in an original form in Greek, was initially, according to the Greek traditions, and in this sense what we are saying is that many of the traditions of the Greek Orthodox Church, with the Greek customs and rites, go back to knowledge that was preserved in the Greek world among many people who became absorbed with that congregation, whose ancestors were members at one time or another of the Church of God in the Greek world. Their tradition is, of course, that Matthew was first written in Hebrew. Now it is logical, if Matthew did write the Gospel first, which I hold to be the case, that's why it's first there, that he would not have addressed it to the Jews in Greek. He would have addressed it to the Jews in Hebrew. And there was no decision at that time what should be what we call the preserved Word of God, the canon of Scripture, or in what language, other than the logical language in which Scripture had always been written, which is Hebrew up to this time. The question, of course, is were the Jews going to preserve it in connection with the law, the prophets, and the writing? At a later time, maybe half a dozen years or so, I am not giving any specific chronological account at this point, there was the need, of course, to reach the Hellenic Jews, the Hellenistic speaking Jews who were living in the area of Antioch in Syria. That is, as the word grew, we were not merely reaching people whose general knowledge of people was sufficient for the church to understand the gospel in Hebrew. The Aramaic was the language of the people, Palestine. But there was the need to have that message written among people of whom we read in the book of Acts who were Hellenistic Jews living in the Greek-speaking areas where Greek rather than Aramaic was certainly the common language of the day. It is my conclusion that the first gospel written in Greek, therefore, was Mark, that it was the second gospel written. Now, the necessity of writing something like this in Greek became obvious, but it was not addressed to Greeks. That should be very plain, because it is assuming all kinds of knowledge. Matthew doesn't assume a knowledge background. He starts out with a genealogy that links the New with the Old Testament. Starts out with a great deal of background material in chapter 1 and 2 of Jesus, whereas Mark plunges right into the story of John the Baptist, as if everybody knew of the events of the time, because he's not doing something original, he's not writing to a people without knowledge. He's clearly writing to Jews, but in a Greek milieu. Now when we come to Luke, interestingly, Luke goes back in the traditional Greek fashion, and addresses the people in the Greek world. Didn't exclude Jews, but most certainly emphasized Greek to background in Greek. We have an introduction here. There were a number of leaders. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a high priest named Zacharias. And now he gives the historic setting from a political point of view and fills in many details. We can go on, I'll just illustrate the point. And it came to pass in those days there was a decree of Augustus Caesar, a reference here fundamentally to the world in which the Greeks lived and moved. Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, the three was Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, Herod was tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip tetrarch of Iturea, and the region of Trachonitis, and Lysanias was the tetrarch of Abilene. And there were individuals in the high priesthood. All of this is clearly something that any Greek could check in terms of the official functioning of the Roman government. And again, as was mentioned, when all of those gospel accounts were finished, there were many customs in the Church of God that had not yet been incorporated in any gospel, and there is no doubt that John writes from the point of view of filling in those details, using it as a framework the next annual holy days in time setting. But he does something very interesting. By this time, the world of Asia, shall we say, the mysteries of the East, had become very commonplace. John is certainly writing hardly earlier than approximately 80 A.D. in the gospel account, or in that period of time, is my general view, and I don't mean to say that I have made any in-depth study of it, because I'm still looking for some very interesting information on the ancient mother. But he writes it from the point of view of people who are involved in philosophy and involved in speculation, where the whole world was in religious ferment. So he starts out, in the beginning was the word, a mystery word anyway. You can call it a noun or a verb, whatever you want, but it has a sense in Latin and verbal of a word of action. In the Greek logos, something of expression. In German and English, it means a word, just like we say it, which is a very peculiar form. And if you were addressing the English language, this would be the last thing we would ever use to define Jesus with. But it was a term that was very common by this time in the Greek and Roman world as a result of philosophy of the East. And the word was with God, the word was God, light shining out of darkness. Those things illustrate the background of the material. And God did choose to have different themes in each one of the accounts. He chose also to have different purposes, and each one being written in the very first place. And I would not draw the conclusion that these were the only four accounts ever written. You don't know any other information than that the four have been preserved. But I wouldn't draw the conclusion either that certainly Mark or Luke were necessarily thinking of Scripture when they wrote it. So you will notice the introduction that Luke uses here, if I may explain. Now, only Matthew and Mark wrote up to this time. I challenge you to explain the following verse. For as much as many have taken in hand to set forth in order a declaration of those things which are most surely believed among us. Now, it said, for as much as two have taken in hand, then you might say we have some basis for only four ever being written. Even as they delivered them to us, which from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also in addition to the many, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, or being in the profession he must have had access to facts and libraries, that although he was not one of the 12, he certainly was able to convey certain information that was very important to the Greek world. Mark was not one of the 12, Luke was not one of the 12, Matthew and John were. So much for what I think is a very light approach to taking a look at some books of the Bible. Now, since sometimes a Sabbath falls on a unique day, such as this pagan day, I think it would be good for us to adopt a practice on occasion, as with Christmas of this past year, and it is past, that you do take in hand the responsibility to examine how New Year's became January 1. That's an interesting way to put it, because New Year's was not previously January 1. I don't think any person going to school, any boy or girl, should have some knowledge of these things in an encyclopedia. You don't have to read our literature on the subject to find the answer, maybe a guide, but go to the encyclopedia that might be available in your local school or public library. You will discover some very interesting things. That Christmas didn't used to be on December 25th. It was on January 6th. The New Year's was not on January 1. It was earlier or later in the year. If you were even to take note of the fact that the early documents for about 125 years since the founding of the British colonies on the East Coast, what we now think is the United States, New Year's was not even January 1. Hence the controversy of the year in which George Washington was born because of the change of calendar afterward. If you consider that the Christmas tree was not a custom among the English-speaking peoples of the New World until after the War of Independence, commemorated 200 years ago, or this year as 200 years ago, and that it really didn't spread throughout Germany until the 1800s and not throughout the rest of the Christian world and non-Christian world till the 1850s, you will understand that ancient traditions sometimes nearly disappear and then are born again, so to speak. Of the flesh. Now it is appropriate to extend publicly the very best wishes and appreciation of my wife and of myself to Mr. and Mrs. Kendall in the second row, or he's in the second row, but your wife has stepped away with the baby. We had a very pleasant Sabbath some few weeks ago en route to Visalia and Fresno. They stayed at their home in Lancaster, which of course is a delightful area of the western United States. It's a beautiful region. I thought traveling through Tehachapi on the way to Visalia was one of the most beautiful areas I have been in. I want to mention that the Ambassador College Library has acquired a book whose title you should know. It was published in 1976, and probably its title is the most significant of any written on the subject, which should have laid to rest some doubts in the ministry, certainly outside of the ministry, and generally speaking in those who left, who questioned that Mr. Armstrong had any understanding of prophecy with respect to the beast, etc., in Revelation chapter 13 or 17, and also in Daniel. Written by an Englishman, the only English historian accepted by Italians is able to write Italian history. The book is entitled Mussolini's Roman Empire, published in 1976. If any of you happen to be in Pasadena, our library has it. Most likely most public libraries do not. I would suggest if they don't have it, you might look in the books in print, which would be in the reference section of the library. Find the title for 1976, Mussolini's Roman Empire, the author and publisher, and take it to the reference library and say, I want this book. But politely, but firmly. Now, maybe it already has the book. I do not know. but it is a relatively new one. And I am pleased to say that the title itself spares you the reading of the rest of it. I would have had my copy here, but when I visited George Beaker, Beaker Trumpets, I left him a gift of the book in appreciation of his feeding me and setting me down there, so we didn't have to have any other expenses. Yesterday I received a book copyrighted in 1977. It's not a mystery. It's only the fact that it was in my hands in advance of the time it normally appears in the bookstores. I'm very grateful in that sense. In terms of your ability to read material, I mentioned to you that Dr. Emanuel Golikovsky has come out with the last, as well as the first volume in his series on Ages and Chaos, titled The Peoples of the Sea. I want to mention this very briefly, because you can read it. It will certainly be in the bookstore. Doubleday publishes, Doubleday advertises, and knows how. Therefore, you can find your own copy of this one with ease. Peoples of the Sea is the story of the 20th and 21st dynasties of Egypt. The 20th dynasty is the period of Ramses III, who is assumed to be contemporary with the period of Saul, or before, that is approximately that period. The dynasty is assumed to have paralleled the time of the Philistines, in the book of Judges, and in early Samuel, in the time of Saul, and the 21st dynasty is assumed to have bridged the period of David to Solomon. And the peoples of the sea are assumed to be the Philistines who had settled on the coast of Palestine in the days of the Judges. So much for the general accepted view. I, of course, for years have mentioned what the real story is. The Philistines were there before Abraham. They were there in the days of Abraham and Isaac, many centuries before the peoples of the sea migrated along the coast. In fact, the peoples of the sea were the Greeks who were hired by the Persians to attack Egypt. And Ramses III was a contemporary of the late kings. The first dynasty high priests, among them was a man who led Alexander the Great to the oasis where he was told that his father was indeed Zeus, Ammon. And all of this material is laid out very clearly. The tombs of any number of these people were assigned by historians to the period of the Philistines. And because it looked so much like the Greeks, they thought the Philistines were in some way Mycenaean Greeks. The Philistines in the Bible spoke Hebrew or a Semitic language. They did not speak an Indo-European. But these facts do not deter historians from inventing explanations of the impossible. I think it is a very interesting thing to recognize that a man has been able, now he is 80 years of age, to complete this volume, and I have recommended the Ages and Chaos. I do not find that everything that is said is correct in any one of these books from the point of view of the fact that he does not take the Bible as the starting point. He does take the Bible as a fundamental reference, therefore he has much greater advantage. Golikovsky is a Jew of some prominence. His father was very prominent in the founding of this, let's say, Hebrew University and the culture of the Hebrew people in Palestine. I have met Dr. Golikovsky and his wife and daughter, Dr. Golikovsky and his wife on a number of occasions. He would view me as a fundamentalist in the sense that I take the Bible for what it says, that manna came from God rather than the planet Venus. I think it's better to eat from God's hand than Venus's. Apart from some of those speculations, I would have to say without a question that this book, which happens to be $10, is very significant in terms of a restoration of the historical perspective of to the Old Testament. I don't believe I paid that much, but that's what it will probably cost. I cannot take the time to have all of you order copies, but if you wish, and one of you wants to do so, I can tell you how you can get your copies for no more than that. That is, you don't have to pay tax or postage, which is the saving. If you want to collect a list of the number of people who are interested, I can order a group of books for you, and some of you would like it, let's say half a dozen or a dozen. And the cost is $10 flat, to my knowledge. I think that's what I paid, which includes postage and everything else. That we could have them available for those of you who have read in the area. I am grateful that we also have the pictures coming from the British Museum, which is very important. The problem was how to explain some of the mysteries of Ramses III in the days of the Philistines, the days of the judges and Saul, where you have on the back of the tiles used in his buildings Greek lettering of the 4th century. All of this has been laid aside as something impossible to explain. Greek lettering of the 4th century were mere symbols of those who had prepared the tiles for his public building. And indeed, that's the period of time when he lived, when we see the whole picture. They are given here in print from the British Museum. I think that was one of the remarkable things that historians for over 70 years have been unwilling to face. But it is very common, of course, for human beings that are out of the church. We are, as human beings, very prone to lay aside strong evidence that needs to be considered that might alter one's view. Now, I should like to mention that there are a few who were attending the morning services in Pasadena who might be attending over here at Mesita. Some might have gone to Glendora, others might have gone to the two Glendale churches or Long Beach or Santa Ana. Some might just find it's very difficult to travel, so the elderly might stay at home. And some will be going this afternoon to the massive mess of paper. They'll be scattered through Pasadena, which I guess is one way to celebrate New Year's. It's a filthy town the day of the parade. Do takes a great deal of effort to clean it up the following day or two. I thought it was the most horrid sight I'd ever seen in my life when I first witnessed the Rose Parade in Pasadena. But anyway, if a few brethren came here, this is a little distance, and would at least certainly extend on behalf of the local staff here to all you brethren. Greetings. If you do not know everyone, you might become acquainted. For those of you who are normally here and do not spot an individual as one who is traditional from the congregation, please get acquainted. I think that would be appropriate on an occasion such as this. And many things have happened since I was here last, and I will just extend a few thoughts and words of greeting, especially from South Africa and the South Pacific. A year ago in October, of course, I had the privilege of being at the Feast of Trumpets with our brethren in Tonga. Shortly afterward, with the brethren in Fiji and in Australia. On the Day of Atonement, being with the brethren in Mauritius and the Feast of Tabernacles in South Africa, where we met a very fine group. We had the main festival site in Victoria. We also had a chance to visit two sites on the southeast coast of Africa, in Georgia on the south, the area where the colored were, was in Cape Town. The whites were in George. The whites were in Victoria. the blacks and Indians were a very undeveloped site, which I loved the best of all, at Oumgababa, which is an appropriate name, I guess. I want to mention that one of our own members is the Director of Agriculture at the New Republic of the Transkei. One of our church members who had a Bible study with me in Pasadena introduced me to two members of the cabinet of the government of South Africa, and thereafter Mr. Henny Smith of Rehoboth-Nama Colored Affairs invited my wife and me to visit Southwest Africa, which we did this past May. One of the members of the 11 population groups at the constitutional meetings that have been going on in Victor, the capital of Southwest Africa, twice written me, expressing in one case his appreciation of the first article when he had not yet read the second. There was a basic applause of the approach of the magazine as expressed in those two articles throughout the Republic of South Africa, for which I am grateful. I try to make it simple. I try to make it plain as to what responsibility the great nations are in a situation like this. Mr. and Mrs. Wasserfall, he's not converted, she is, are members in Bintook. Mrs. Wasserfall is a noted artist in Southwest Africa. We had the chance to meet the director of the museum as well as a number of the political officials that I mentioned. We had a chance also to visit with a brother of one of the members who is in the white opposition in Rhodesia, who told many of the inside, shall I say, tales or stories of the events in Rhodesia itself. I would like you to keep your mind on this part of the world. A great deal of pressure is being brought to bear on Rhodesia and Southwest Africa. Break these two countries down, refusal by the United Nations to recognize the Transkei, which has achieved independence in peace, though it is economically dependent on Southwest Africa, as most third world nations are dependent on others. But since it happened in peace and not by war, as Angola or Mozambique, it should not be recognized. And that, of course, is the stupid thinking of the United Nations. But I think we need to see the total world perspective for what it is. Angola wouldn't even have a government now if it weren't for human troops there. But that's the situation. From South Africa, Mr. Armstrong wrote a co-worker letter dated the 19th of November, which has precipitated many comments. So would you please explain it again? It wasn't quite clear, and I thought it appropriate, whether some few of you heard my explanation before, perhaps to give it from a slightly different style or point of view, but I should like to comment on it, since I think it is important for us to see it. It will be a very slightly revised form, and hopefully clearer, therefore, just a few words or phrases or sentences that most can clear up sometimes certain things that are not altogether clear. If you have Mr. Herbert Armstrong had a chance to read it, let's say from italics, it might have been resolved a little better, but we could always comment later. This is in reference to his statements regarding the 11th and the 10th chapters of the book of Revelation, the work that he is doing. Now, we'll try to explain where some of the problems arose, if there were doubts as to the meaning, what Mr. Armstrong may or may not have emphasized. Maybe he didn't spot everything. His explanation might vary slightly, but I do not have any doubt in my mind that if we would sit down and talk, the reason it was unclear is that there was one fundamental word that he did not emphasize, which had he done so would probably have made it clear. It would certainly then have been easier for him to have clarified it. Some of our brethren wrote and said, "Now I know, Mr. Armstrong, you really want us to understand because you took so many pages to write it. Could you please explain?" One of the misunderstandings that was utterly unfounded was that Mr. Armstrong was saying that we were reaching peoples and tongues and nations and kings for 3.5 years since 1972, and how come we're in 76 and it's only 3.5 years? I don't think everybody stumbled on that, but a sufficient number did, because they didn't even read carefully. So it brings to my attention that sometimes an author can neglect to emphasize that which is most important, that people very often read ideas into a chapter. But Mr. J. Armstrong has not grasped the picture as his father sees it. He rather looks at it much as probably the majority of church members did at the time they read the co-worker letter. I will state that, generally speaking, in our literature, we have viewed chapter 10 in the book of Revelation as in some way connected with the sixth trumpet, the sixth angel it sounds in chapter 9, verse 13. In chapter 9, verse 13, the sixth angel sounds, and then there comes chapter 10, and then there is chapter 11 through verse 13. And then the second bowl, which says is passed, the third bowl comes quickly, and the seventh angel sounded, and that's, of course, the time of the resurrection, when the nations are angry, verse 18, and their wrath has come in the time of the dead, that they should be judged, which is an incorrect translation. It's the time of the nations, which is the proper rendering of the Byzantine Greek. It is not the time of the dead that they should be judged. That's 1,000 years later. It's the time of the nations that they should be judged, and that you should give reward to your servants, the prophets, and to the saints who are not included in this period of the time of the judgment of the nation. So the word dead should be stricken. That is an erroneous rendering. The proper meaning is nations, and there isn't any doubt that the Greeks have it right. And you should destroy those who destroy the earth. Now we used to understand, of course, that Revelation 11, verses 1 through 13, was an inset. That is, that sometimes in writing a story, much as Velikovsky has done it, he has written a story of this period from Persia through Alexander to the Ptolemies, and then he goes back and tells the whole story again from another point of view. Now, in the same way, we recognize that by the time you are in the sounding of the sixth trumpet, you only have one more to go, which is the resurrection. And very clearly, chapter 11, the first 13 verses, is not something that takes place between the sixth trumpet and the seventh trumpet, but rather is an inset that fills in the story of what is taking place with respect to the church, the ministry, near the close of the work. And it is for a 3.5 year period that we have reference here in chapter 11, the first 13 verses. Now, this inset, we did recognize as occurring, but our assumption was that all of chapter 10 was a continuation of the sixth trumpet, the sixth angel that sounds this trumpet, sixth in sequence. What we did not recognize, of course, is how an inset chapter begins. Thus, chapter 12 begins in a unique way. Let's take a quick note. There appeared a great wonder in heaven. Chapter 13, verse 1. There is a beast that rises out of the sea. That's another inset in the sequence. It goes way back into history. Chapter 13, verse 11 is another inset, and I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth. And we could go on. I saw in chapter 15 a sign in heaven. And then you clearly have chapter 17. There was one of the seven angels which had seven vials, and he talked with me and said, I will show you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth had committed fornication. And so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast. And then in chapter 18, another inset going back to show the whole economic system. And after these things, I saw another angel come down.
And he showed me this Babylonian system in all its economic perspective, just like Revelation 17 has its perspective historically. But if you read carefully in chapter 11, verse 1, it just says in there, "Was given me a reed like a rod, and the angel stood, saying, Rise and measure the temple of God." And it's right in the middle of the thought, which is what we did not carefully take note of. We were focusing in all of the rest of the chapter so much, we didn't note that chapter 11, verse 1, does not introduce the inset, but is only in the middle of an inset, which ends with verse 13. And in fact, the inset begins with chapter 10, verse 1. "And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head, and his face was as it were that of the sun, his feet as pillars of fire. And he had a little book open, and he set his right foot on the sea and the left on the earth." Now at this point, we begin to see a major introduction, much like the story of this woman in chapter 12, a great marvelous sign in the heavens. So what we did not see before, because we could not understand it in the earlier days of this work, was that this is an inset chapter, of which 11 is only a part and not the only inset. Let's get that clearly in mind then. To say that chapter 10 has to be in the day of the Lord merely because it follows the sixth angel blowing the sixth trumpet would be to say that therefore chapter 11 verses 1 to 13 must also be, which of course is not the case. Because there, you have a picture quite different in terms of what is going to take place when you compare that with Daniel. And if we can have an inset for 13 verses in chapter 11, you can just as well have an inset earlier. And when you see how the two chapters are bridged, let's look at the end of chapter 10. "Now I took this little book," says John, "out of the angel's hands and ate it up, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey, and as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. Now he said to me, you must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. And there was given me a reed likened to a rod, and the angel stood saying," and obviously the angel in chapter 13, chapter 11, verse 1, is the same one who was there in chapter 10, verses 10 and 11. It goes right on. The chapter division is of man, it isn't of God. It should never have been divided there. Had that not occurred, had chapters properly been used, and very likely we're going to divide the Bible in such a way that there will be proper paragraphing in the modern sense to convey meaning that is now lost in this manner. Then we would have understood it in part. But even if we had understood chapter 10 as an inset, we couldn't have understood its meaning, because there was a time before which this work was not involved in speaking to peoples and nations and tongues and kings, the kings being the important aspect of it. Now let's take a look at what Mr. Armstrong did or did not say in terms of clarity. When we understand this point, I think that the mystery of what he was saying will become clear. Now, he mentions that you must prophesy before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings, and then the two witnesses are introduced in chapter 11. Whose function is defined there, and when they have finished their testimony, they are killed, and they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations, their leaders, as well, shall see their dead bodies, and then it ends with the resurrection and the return of Christ, as you will see as it goes on. Now, to speak before people and nations, tongues and kings, as the 12 to the two witnesses, is what Mr. Armstrong said. Now, what he didn't say, and if you look carefully in the way that I suggested to Brian Knowles,
we handle it as it will appear in the February issue, with the plain truth, I guess it is. You will see a variation between the original letter, co-worker letter, November 19, and the article as it appears. I suggested to Brian Knowles that he italicize or capitalize one word in verse 11 of chapter 10, which I failed to read more than once to draw attention to it. He said to me, "You must prophesy again." And Mr. Armstrong failed to italicize or capitalize or emphasize that word again, which, had he done so, I think would have made it clear. You must prophesy again before many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings, which presumes that if the two witnesses are to prophesy before kings again, they have done it before. That clear? Now, if it is to be done by the two witnesses again, then it has been done before. Now, this was all done years ago in this person of John, maybe 95, 96 AD in that period. And John, of course, being the apostle, the leading and only one of the 12 left at the time, is responsible for conveying to us the message and symbolically going through his own experience, having preached before peoples, nations, tongues, and kings prior to his imprisonment in the early 90s, I presume, by Domitian. When Domitian died in 96, he was released, and the implication he too would do it again. Now, if the two witnesses are to do it again, therefore it must also be done before. That is clear. If it isn't, there's some opacity in your own thinking. John makes it plain. Now, if this is to be done again by two witnesses who are next introduced, speaking before the world, and the whole world is upset by them, because, as I did not read, but you undoubtedly have read, and they that dwell upon the earth will rejoice over them and make merry, because the two prophets tormented those that dwelt on the earth so that everybody would know what was being said sufficiently. And if the common people knew, the kings most certainly did. This would presume, therefore, that the tribulation, which parallels the first part of the 3.5 years referred to in chapter 11, the tribulation could not begin in 1972 because the church had not yet reached many peoples, nations, tongues, and kings. And that we did not understand. We did not grasp that there was a part of the work prior to 72 that had been accomplished. Would to God it had been done by then, but it wasn't. That still needed to be before it's to be done again, in this case by two witnesses with supernatural power, because the church doesn't have the capacity in this world of tribulation and persecution with the Gentiles treading down the holy city to accomplish it as we do now. We can sit here in this Masonic temple. There's coming a time when there won't even be Masonic temples allowed